Hello, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who is stuck on a dark desert highway with cool wind in his hair. Yes, folks, he is in Hotel California, where they still don't have the internet. Who knew? Today, I am joined by my regular co-panelists, Nick Gillespie and Catherine Mengi Ward, as well as special guest, Reason's very own Christian Britschke. Everybody say hi.
Howdy.
Good morning.
Hello, Peter.
Happy Monday. So today is January 8th, 2024, which means we are exactly 1 week away from the very first voting event on the GOP primary calendar. Former President Donald Trump has a commanding lead in national polls, as well as in Iowa specifically, where he's currently polling at about 50%. Meanwhile, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley are in a tight race for a distant second place. Trump looks like the runaway winner in this race. But of all the candidates, it is Nikki Haley whose campaign has shown the most unexpected energy. So we are going to name this segment after an underappreciated Adam Sandler movie from the turn of the millennium, Little Nikki. Over the last 6 months, Haley has beaten expectations. She's become something close to the default candidate for Republicans, and especially elite Republicans, Republicans with power, prestige, who don't like Donald Trump. Haley is, rhetorically at least, a fiscal conservative. She talks a big game about reducing federal debt and controlling entitlement spending. She's also a hawkish internationalist who views America as the essential nation in the global fight for freedom, or in Trump speak, she likes the globe. He likes America first. She is not exactly the second coming of Ronald Reagan, but she is as close to that description as 2024 has on offer. Even some of us on this podcast have had a few nice things to say about Haley. So in advance of next week's Iowa caucusing, I want to go around the room and get your take on her specifically. Catherine, let's start with you. You have, from time to time, praised Nikki Haley for her really sharp high heels jokes. Big picture. How should libertarians think about her and what she represents in the Republican Party right now?
Thank you, Peter. As a lady, I have some thoughts about Nikki Haley.
Yeah.
And
I didn't say that.
I know, but I miss Matt, so I'm doing my best. Although if I really missed Matt, I could listen to Nikki Haley's mixed metaphors, which are Welshian in their nature. They are really very bad. She absolutely just puts all of the like political words in a bag and scrambles them around and then reaches them out. So I think we're going to have a cancer moonshot for criminal justice or something. I can't remember what we're doing now.
We need more cancer. That's for sure.
We do. The war on cancer is not producing enough cancer or something.
No. It's the other way around. She is going to cure cancer with a moonshot, by which I mean with rockets. So you should be in favor of this, Catherine.
It's a mental health cancer moonshot. Anyway, all of this is by way of saying Nikki Haley has had some verbal stumbles, which people are paying attention to in these last couple of weeks, because this is in some ways the last stand. This is the last time we will pay attention to Nikki Haley unless something dramatic happens with Donald Trump or otherwise in this primary season. I still believe what I said early on when she emerged into the public spotlight in this cycle, which is she says good stuff about a few topics that I care about, and she would govern as a Republican, which I am not. Republicans are not libertarians, and she would not be a libertarian in office. I know you're shocked to hear it.
My God.
We're not even just Republicans who like to smoke pot. We're this whole other thing. The spending issue is huge. And she rhetorically is the best on it, and that matters. I appreciate having someone on the stage who says over and over not only that overspending is bad, but also that Republicans have been as guilty of it as Democrats. That's a really important message. And I hope she keeps saying it as she slowly vanishes into the West, perfectly irrelevant as Donald Trump stomps across America.
I just want to point out, and she does it
in heels.
High heels.
Yeah.
Whereas Ron DeSantis just wears very feminine looking duck boots.
I also appreciate when he walks around
muddy Florida swamps.
I've said this as well. I appreciate that she is a realist in terms of the practical politics of some of the more sort of traditionalist conservative goals that Republicans have. I'm thinking here of her standard answer on abortion, which is very good, and notes that a federal ban on abortion is probably not in the cards and that people shouldn't go around promising it because that's not a promise that they can keep. Stuff like that, I continue to admire her for. She, though, does like to do all the wars and also keep all of the children and some of the adults off of the cool stuff on the internet.
Ron DeSantis is running a lot of ads against Nikki Haley in Iowa right now, and at least some number of them are hitting her on social issues, and in particular on the trans kids issue, where her position is just that the government shouldn't tell parents what parents can decide. And that's it. And that's her position on this. And so it's really telling that that's the place where Ron DeSantis has decided to go after her. I mean, Iowa is traditionally a pretty socially conservative state and a socially conservative race, but even still. Nick, Catherine talked a lot said that the fiscal issues were really important. And during the primary debates, Haley has provided, I think, some of the most limited government-friendly answers about debt, deficits, runaway federal spending, unsustainable entitlements, and even, as Catherine noted, talking about GOP complicity in this. She says the Republican Party is part of the problem. But these sorts of big picture fiscal issues are hard to deal with from the White House alone, at least without help from Congress. And as we have seen so many times, small government rhetoric doesn't always lead to small government policy. And this, of course, you know, just tables the fact that she is almost certainly not going to be president at all. So how seriously should we take Nikki Haley on these issues? How should we think about what her stance represents in the current GOP field?
I think we should take it seriously. And as a sign of hope, she's not quite popping out of R2-D2 in a hologram, but she may be the last hope here or a message to whoever, whatever. And I'm already wandering
down. This is a Haleyan
metaphor.
I'm
about to go into hyperspace with a Chewbacca and baby Chewbacca. This is Star Wars Christmas special stuff. She may be the last person to be pushing a hologram or a holographic call for help to whatever Obi-Wan Kenobi may be out there to actually save the federal budget.
It's like the ghost of Ronald Reagan, right? Right. Yeah. Fought with her father in the Clone Wars.
What she did do in the fall, and she's repeated this since, is she said in her big economic freedom speech, I will veto any spending bill that doesn't take us back to pre-COVID spending levels. That is a, you know, that's a great declaration in a world gone mad, because what that would mean is, you know, in 2023, we spent about $6.1 trillion. She has committed to bringing us back to $4.5 trillion. So that's a lot of cuts in year over year spending the first year she gets elected. It's nice to have somebody saying something like that, because Trump isn't saying it. DeSantis isn't really saying it. Chris Christie was saying this a bit less in large numbers and more about entitlement spending. And she's also good on that, where she has said, again, these are all in the super watered down, kind of homeopathic cure versions for entitlement spending. But she also has said, if you're in your 40s, 50s, 60s or older, you know, entitlements will remain the same. But if you're just entering the workforce, we're going to push back retirement age, et cetera, and try to extend them. Again, it's not libertarian. It is not my preferred, reform of blowing up entitlement spending for old age things, Medicare and Social Security in particular, and really building a new, a whole new policy to help poor people in America. But she is, I think, the only person on the stage in either party who's actually talking in these terms. So, to that extent, it's a good thing, but you also recognize she is stuck in the past, because she's still talking about, the problem with entitlement spending, it's a math problem. It's not a larger conceptual issue about government. Every time there is some dumb passing moment to, lash out at modernity, whether it is online anonymity, whether it is creating a TSA for schools, she'll do it. She's in the past, but she is absolutely when it comes to spending, the best of the bunch out there.
It is really sad that the very best of the bunch is someone who is just kind of sort of saying the thing and describing it as a math problem, which it is. And I think actually the math problem thing is, it's a math problem first and foremost. You have to get through the math problem before you solve the rest of it, I think. But it is always...
No, I actually, it's, always a little it's bit... not a math problem, I think. I mean, for me, this is my biggest contention with her, you know, is that no, entitlements cannot be saved. It's not a math problem. The math shows it's not going to work unless you're going to cauterize the economy in a significant way by expanding all income gets taxed. She's also talked about cutting taxes continually and getting rid of the federal gas tax while also, not getting rid of entitlements. So in the near term, so
not a math problem, but a fundamental problem with math. Christian, I think one of the things that people like about Haley is that she seems more or less like a responsible and competent and reasonably intelligent adult rather than a doddering maniac. But in national politics, responsible adult often means someone who really, really likes war. And I think that's probably true with Haley as well. So how does one balance that against some of her more appealing qualities? How do you sort of think about the mix of, oh, she's a super hawk, but also she's not completely crazy and really old and out of her gourd?
Yeah, I would weight her very interventionist foreign policy pretty heavily, given that as a president, that's the area that you have the most control over. And to be clear, she is a super hawk. She continues this recent trend of former Republican-appointed UN ambassadors being like really bloodthirsty interventionists. So for instance, she's an unreconstructed War on Terror supporter. You know, she's criticized Biden for not bombing Iraq and Syria enough. She uses all these like 20-year-old zingers about how we can't live in a world of September 10th anymore. You know, this is September 12th. And, you know, we were talking about how she's good on spending, but, you know, even the one item it seemed like Republicans in Congress now are willing to cut from the budget, which is Ukraine aid, she's very against that. You know, she talks about how if the United States doesn't give unlimited support to Ukraine's war against Russia, the next step is, Russian tanks are going to be rolling into Warsaw and who knows, maybe Berlin. And so that puts her definitely on the more hawkish side of basically all Democrats. But it also shows that she hasn't really learned any of the lessons some Republicans and some other Republican presidential candidates have learned, that America can't bomb its way into global hegemony, peace and freedom. And again, because you
sure
know, she's
can try.
she's willing to try and she's willing to spend a lot of tax dollars to do it. But no, she wants to bring back the war on terror. She wants to have limitless commitments to Ukraine, to Israel's war in Gaza. And like all other GOP candidates, she's super hawkish on China. And as I said, when you're the executive, you know, for right or wrong, you have, you know, almost unilateral control over foreign policy. And so that makes her a very worrisome candidate indeed.
Yeah, this is, I think, one of the things that people just need to hear over and over again is that the president has a lot less power, direct power over spending than over foreign policy. And so in some ways, just for the office of president, if you're just kind of thinking about the power structure, you need to really weight a candidate's foreign policy stances, because that is where that individual in the White House would have the most direct influence. Let's drill down a little bit here. Nick already mentioned a couple of Haley's zanier ideas, but I want to get into some of the specifics and go around the table here. The round table, that's what you do with a round table. You go around it and have each of you talk a little bit about one specific Nikki Haley proposal and what you think about it, what we should think about it. Catherine, let's start with you.
Yeah, the plan to basically eliminate the scourge that is TikTok from our shores is the main preoccupation that I have with a Haley-specific proposal. Now, of course, many other Republicans have some variation of this, and even a bunch of Democrats, so she's hardly alone in it. But Haley seems to bring, a certain amount of zeal to this that maybe others don't have, and it would be deeply unwise. this is an issue of free speech, and free speech, a commitment to an understanding of free speech is extremely important in any person who hopes to be president of the United States, and Haley simply doesn't have it.
Influencer dance videos are protected expression.
They are. They super are.
It depends on the context, doesn't it? Didn't we learn anything from all those Ivy League presidents?
Right. In particular, her use of these like absurd statistics like, you know, every second that you spend on TikTok makes you 17% more anti-Semitic or whatever. I mean, she's like just...
How does one measure that? Like, what is the meter that you're sticking in people's brains to find out the percentage anti-Semitic like viewpoint increase?
On loan from the Church of Scientology, I'm sure.
Right. I mean, you know, this actually gets, of course, to a larger issue, which Reason has
covered. To be clear, there's a lot of like pro-Hamas content on TikTok, as far as I can tell.
Well, even if it's 1%, it's still bad, right?
Christian. But, you know, this actually gets to the larger issue that there are many, many bad studies that purport to show, or that people will kind of marshal to show, that social media are ruining the brains of America or America's young people. But yeah, I guess we should say it's for every 30 minutes that someone watches TikTok every day, they become 17% more anti-Semitic, comma, more pro-Hamas based on doing that. That's what she said.
Wow.
That's ridiculous.
Was she drunk?
No, that's the issue, right? Like that was like stone cold sober Nikki Haley. And, you know, I have no doubt that she bungled results from a real study, but the fact that that was a sentence that came out of her mouth and she didn't immediately say, oh, no, wait, what I just said was bonkers and obviously untrue, let me try again, shows that there's just a very heavy bias against people having the freedom to use social media.
Nick, one Nikki Haley proposal you want to talk about.
Yeah, the TSA for schools, which she articulated a couple of days ago in the wake of a school shooting, you know, that this is what we need. We need to harden schools somehow and give them more security, and that the problem with school shootings, you know, will be solved by creating not just a shitty, you know, security bureaucracy, but the one that has replaced the post office as an, you know, as a generalized object of ridicule and an indicator of how bad the government is at doing what it says it's going to be doing. So thank you, Nikki Haley.
It's really remarkable that she proposed basically a TSA for schools, given that is there like some secret fan club of the TSA who's like, yeah, you know what? They're doing a great job. And I really, that pat down was the best I've ever had.
I don't even notice them anymore. They have magic fingers now after 20 plus years on the job. You know, part of the problem is that we have, you know, I mean, the TSA has become the background. I flew over the weekend a total of 12 hours, and I have TSA pre. I assume that means I'm part of the problem because we should be throwing our bodies on the machine and you know, so that it stops and it grinds us up and it halts. But I want to get through TSA a little bit quicker. And even TSA pre is fucked up these days. And the wait lines for TSA, you know, and there's a government agency that actually looks at this, they're getting slower over time, surprisingly, not
Christian,
building up and becoming quicker.
Christian, one Nikki Haley proposal you want to talk about?
Okay, yeah, sure. So since I did criticize her for, you know, wanting to send America's sons and daughters to die in war, I should probably say something nice. And
she want to send non-binary people.
Even worse.
Yeah,
even
you
worse.
Know, because she is aggressively pro-trans, according to Ron DeSantis.
Or she's responsible for the trans genocide, maybe also, if she's going to send them to the wars. We don't know. Both.
Be that as it may. So in the last debate, she was the only candidate to answer the only question about housing. And she reflexively mentioned that we should deregulate mortgage financing so more people can afford a home. And I think that's actually an undercovered issue in the housing affordability debate. Obviously, like, zoning restrictions get a lot of attention for stopping housing from being built. But the inability of a lot of people to qualify for mortgages post-Great Recession also prevents a lot of people from financing new construction. So I think that's important too.
That is a good suggestion. So before we move on, I want to talk just a little bit more.
Wait, what is that more people should be able to get mortgages that are going to be ultimately are going to be subsidized by the government?
No, not that they would be subsidized.
I'm not saying that, Christian. I'm just saying, like, yeah. You know, how are we going to make people, how is she going to make it easier for people to get mortgages?
She didn't really go into details in the debate, but again, like the inability of people to finance a new home. You know, if you listen, you take the Kevin Erdman argument that this is something that not only that contributed to the Great Recession and then also kind of a persistent housing affordability problems post Great Recession. And so the fact that she's even talking about it, I think, is interesting. So,
yeah, I mean, that's that I agree with Christian here. The wonky details are in some ways sort of secondary to the fact that she is even referencing a particular and specific plan to do any of this. That sort of thing is increasingly rare in the Republican Party specifically. And it's nice that there's somebody out there who actually seems like they are paying attention to some of those little details. So before we move on, I do want to talk about just one more little Nikki Haley moment. There was I don't even know if I want to call it a scandal, but it was definitely a kerfuffle, like a mini kerfuffle, which is definitely my favorite Little Debbie snack. But basically, Haley was asked about what she thought the Civil War was about. And the answer she gave was that the war was, and these are quotes, basically it was about basically how the government was going to run and, quote, freedoms and what people could and couldn't do. And she didn't mention slavery at all. So I want to know what folks think about this. How important is this kind of gaffe? What does it tell us about Haley or the Republican Party? Catherine?
I find it awfully hard to believe that in 2024, there are people running for president who are unaware that the Civil War was about slavery in part, in very large part, particularly someone of Haley's background. And I think this is a dumb controversy. And I know that for whatever jokey reason, I am the like Haley partisan on this podcast. And believe you me, I am not.
Well, you know, it's the tattoo you got.
Here, it's the Nikki Haley tattoo. Nick, I told you not to tell people about that.
You got to start wearing full back dresses again.
Yeah. You know? Damn. Okay.
If you don't want people to talk.
Well, you know, she's bad. She would be a bad president. She would not be libertarian. I'll say it again. However, I just don't think that we like, aha, gotcha, you love slavery. Like, I just don't think that's what happened here. I think what happened here is this is a kind of variety of players interesting in dealing a death blow to the Haley campaign. And hey, dumber things have brought down candidates in the past. She should have said that slavery is bad. Because it is.
Well, the worst thing is her comments, she plagiarized them from Claudine Gay.
Yeah.
In that.
Yeah. And I'm a little hesitant to like minimize this because I had a similar reaction very, very, very early on in the Claudine Gay scandal. I was like, yeah, God, I don't know. This seems like maybe it's just a couple of small things. And then it was like, oh, no, JK, she plagiarized like 10,000 things. So I suppose if we find voluminous evidence that Nikki Haley never mentioned slavery when talking about the Civil War in her long career, I would have to, change my view here.
Well, she did give a big talk when she, she pulled the the Confederate battle flag out of the South Carolina state flag. And people have been getting on her for that because when she did that, she was not explicitly condemning slavery as much as saying, our history and our heritage is a problem and we're going to take it out of the flag, which everybody hailed at the time as a good thing. I agree with Catherine. I think this is, this is the kind of shitty tertiary level possible, miscall, audible, blah, blah, blah. I don't think it really says very much about Nikki Haley or anything. The point that she can always bring up is that she ran South Carolina. She was a popular governor in a state that has, that was the beginning of the Civil War, the first state to secede from the Union and to fire on Union troops, et cetera, like that. And she navigated all of the politics and all of the history of that pretty well. So,
Yes, in general, she's been good on these issues. But I do think that that moment, if you actually go back and look at the full exchange, tells you a little bit about the GOP electorate and even more what Nikki Haley thinks about the GOP electorate. Because, in fact, the way that that question and answer unfolded was that somebody asked, well, what is the Civil War about? And the first thing she says isn't, well, it's about our rights and our freedoms and the government and not mentioning slavery. The first thing she says is, well, what do you think it was about? Because she is quizzing them to see if they want to hear a slavery answer or a more general answer, if they are like which side they're on here. And she is the answer she gave suggests that she is a little bit afraid to say that it's about slavery in the context of the modern GOP primary electorate. And that itself tells us at least a little bit about Nikki Haley and maybe a little bit about GOP primary voters. But
don't get us started on what it tells us about the libertarian movement. If you ask that question to libertarians, and a good chunk of them
that
will be, oh, well, it was
is
about
a
the
segment.
Seems like you did just get us started on
table for slaves, for owning slaves, you know.
That is a segment for some other host. So we're going to move on to the next segment here, because it's not just Republicans who are picking a presidential candidate. Democrats, too, are looking at their options, and they are not feeling so good. This week, a couple of long-shot candidates for the Democratic nomination, Marianne Williamson and Dean Phillips, will be having a debate in New Hampshire. And you know what? Doesn't seem like it's going to matter one bit. Democrats are treating President Joe Biden as a lock for their presidential nomination, and in some ways that is fair enough. He is, after all, the incumbent, the sitting president. But a lot of prominent Democrats actually seem pretty terrified about his prospects at the ballot box this November. Among those prominent Democrats who are worried, former President Obama, who reportedly took issue with Biden's slow-moving bureaucratic campaign setup at a private lunch recently. And here, I'm just going to read you the opening sentence to an Axios report that was published this weekend. Lots of high-level Democrats are warning that President Biden and his re-election team are too complacent and unimaginative about the threat of losing to Donald Trump, sources tell us. And yet, despite all of these high-level Democrats being worried, it also seems like anybody who wants to challenge Biden is facing an uphill battle just to get on the ballot. There's a recent ABC News report about long-shot Democratic candidates encountering what they believe is, quote, a broader conspiracy between the party elites and state chapters to bend the process in Biden's favor. It's always those dang elites. Basically, the party is just sticking Biden on the ballot and calling it a day. So we are going to call this segment the Joke's on You.
Woof.
Catherine? Yep, that's what we're doing. If Democrats are so worried about Joe Biden's electoral chances, is there anything they could, I don't know, do about that?
I listened this morning to The Daily, which I do sometimes, the New York Times morning podcast about the news, and I was catching up on some past ones. They had two back-to-back dailies about kind of the state of play, the campaigns of both Trump and Biden. And the Biden podcast was mostly just this conversation that was like, so there's nothing Joe Biden can do about the fact that he's really, really old. And even though the economy is totally good, people don't feel great about it. And most of his signature legislative accomplishments are like pretty slow burn stuff, like the bridges that he paid for. They're going to like take a while to build and stuff. Seems tough. Like it was just very interesting because like even, reporters who... Yeah, the odds suggest would like be likely Biden supporters trying to talk about this in an objective way.
Wait, you're telling me New York Times journalists
Democrats. I know, it's shocking and surprising, but kind of throwing up their hands in terms of, you know, the podcast ended with them saying like, yeah, he might need to work on his messaging, but it's not clear what like the new message could be that would win people over. And they did note, you know, that this is sort of a classic thing that people always talk about when they talk about campaign strategy. If Joe Biden loses, Peter, it will be because he is too noble. He is too good for this world. And he has chosen not to focus on Donald Trump's legal troubles. And this is true, right? Like, I mean, we have lots of intel from inside his campaign that they have strategically chosen not to talk about the fact that he is facing, you know, four discrete sets of potential legal disasters in the next year. And, you know, but there's still, it's like this weird, like preparing to lose because he's too good for this world vibe that I guarantee you is not happening on the Republican side of the aisle.
I love the way that every time a Democratic presidential candidate or president gets in trouble, they eventually just decide, like the party apparatus and the commentariat eventually just decides, well, it's a messaging problem. You never have to do anything different. You No. just have to describe it differently. And guess what? Guess what? Joe Biden spent the summer delivering, like trying to defend his record with a new messaging strategy. By saying, you know what, it's Bidenomics and I'm going to own that and it's good. And it didn't work. It didn't work at all. In fact,
pivot
perceptions
to Bidenomics,
of the economy
pivot to
went
dust.
Down and they eventually just they eventually dropped it. Biden has all but dropped mentions of Bidenomics from his public remarks. Nick, I want to know what you think of this. What does it tell us about the Democratic Party specifically, but also about the state of the two-party system? That Democrats are aggressively blocking and tackling for a candidate that they don't really believe in.
What I think it says is that the Democrats have as narrow a bench as the Republicans. They are stuck in the same way that the Republicans seem stuck with Donald Trump. The Democrats are stuck with Joe Biden, who is out of it. Has a bad record to run on, despite all of the cheerleading that he's getting from the media and whatnot. People don't like him. He has approval ratings that rival Trump's at this point in Trump's single term. And it doesn't seem like that's going to turn around. What's interesting to me about New Hampshire is that, you know, he's technically not on the ballot, so he's got to get written in. And his people are looking for a 50% to hopefully a 60% win in New Hampshire as a write-in candidate. Whether or not that happens, we'll see. But what, you know, if you go back to 1992 and 96, Pat Buchanan was a troublemaker on the Republican side, first with George H.W. Bush, where he ended up getting 38% of the of the vote in the New Hampshire primary. And that really wounded H.W. Bush as he moved into the general election for the first several primaries. Buchanan got between 38 and 25% of the vote. There isn't that kind of insurgency against Biden right now, but I think a weak showing in New Hampshire will open up possible narratives to start, or counter narratives to start. And from a, you know, from a political perspective, I would find that interesting. I think we again are looking at Biden versus Trump, and it's like, this is not Ali Frazier. This is not two boxers who are actually really good at what they do and are bringing their punching power in an increasing, you know, set of contests. These are two old men who are effectively brain dead. And, you know, I don't see what happens. What is the asteroid that hits or something that gets us out of an incredibly dreary 2024?
Christian, you are a little younger than me, but I suspect you remember the 2016 election in which the Democratic establishment basically picked Hillary Clinton and said she was going to be the nominee. Clinton got all the resources, all the party support, despite polls saying that she wasn't particularly popular. So just refresh my memory. Like, how did that go for them in 2016? And maybe, are there any lessons there?
Well, she got the Democratic nomination, so I guess it went okay. So she obviously had a very tough fight to get the Democratic nomination against Bernie Sanders. I don't think we're going to see some sort of repeat of that in 2024, though, because Bernie Sanders, unlike he had an actual ideological and kind of character critique of Hillary Clinton that resonated with a lot of the base of the Democratic Party and just, you know, people who would conceivably vote for a Democrat if they were to enter the polling booth. Whereas I don't think you really see that kind of ground. Like, there is dissatisfaction with Biden and his performance, but it's mostly just about the man himself. There's not really like an ideological critique there. And so I think that makes it very difficult for Democrats who might want to try and run some sort of insurgent campaign against Biden, you know, already trying to unseat a sitting president of your own party in a primary. That's a very difficult thing to do. I don't believe that's happened in American history, or at least in recent American history. And so you kind of need something more than just, I'm the electable one who will basically do the things Biden is doing, but also, you know, be able to talk cogently and, you know, be able to work past, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, I think it's a tough spot the Democrats are in because they don't really have policy criticisms of Biden. That's exactly right. But even more than that, I think the likelihood of another Biden-Trump matchup, despite the fact that both candidates are just deeply unpopular, shows how broken the two parties are and how kind of enthralled they are to the worst parts of their coalitions. And I think this state of affairs is partly a result of years of party maneuvers that have been designed to shut down consideration of alternatives. When that happens for a long time, you get rotten candidates. And that's what we're seeing now. But in other ways, it's actually even bigger than that. And it's part of a larger crisis. America is just totally devoid of competent national political leadership right now. And that is why Haley has outperformed expectations, because at her best, she comes across as a basically competent, non-insane person, someone who isn't essentially ridiculous or crazy, someone who isn't fundamentally embarrassing.
That's a great bumper sticker right there.
Right? I mean, like, bad in a lot of ways. And that is relatedly a lesson for libertarians, because a lot of these competent-seeming candidates are not going to be folks who we agree with or find all that appealing in terms of actual policy and governance.
How's the Libertarian Party candidate coming, Peter? What's the bumper sticker for that?
I'm going to let you write that one, yeah. Nick. The bumper sticker is, why do we have to have a bumper sticker? Safetyism is bullshit.
That's right. Or let's get
bumpers,
out of our cars.
Bumpers are
let's
bad,
get out of our
right?
cars.
No, why I, do we have I mean, to have bumpers?
It's also true. I mean, if you want to expand like the complete sense of exhaustion, even the third parties suck now. There isn't the Green Party, the Reform Party, if that even still exists anymore, the Libertarian Party are in shambles. There's something system-wide at every level. There are essentially no interesting candidates who command anything, you know, worthy of attention, really.
Yeah. And that's why this is all so frustrating, because I think a lot of the problem is that no one trusts institutional leadership anymore, which is why so much of it ends up in the hands of self-aggrandizing, embarrassing fools. And that's a bad situation. And on that happy note, we will go to a sponsor. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You've all heard the saying, new year, new you. But maybe you should be thinking the opposite of that, or at least something a little bit more manageable. So around New Year's, we all become obsessed with how to change ourselves, instead of just expanding on what we're already doing right. Maybe you're crushing it on the deadlift, but you'd really like to improve your bench press. Maybe you're writing regular short essays, but you really want to put together a book. Therapy helps you find your strengths, so you can ditch the extreme resolutions and make changes that really stick. Therapy can help you learn positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who have experienced major trauma or have serious problems. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, and it's designed to be convenient and flexible. It will fit your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. All right, let's go to our reader question. This comes from Al for a segment we are going to call Insurrexexection. Al writes, cheers, Reason Roundtable.
So
happy New Year, and thank you for a great year of podcasts. You're welcome. Question: on the anniversary of 1/6 of January 6th, what is worse, trashing Nancy Pelosi's office or filming yourself having anal sex in a Senate hearing room? Catherine.
Trashing Nancy Pelosi's office, dude. I mean, I thought about if I had a creative answer to this question. And I have only a lame answer to this question, which is that as far as I know, and I guess that like maybe we're still in the discovery phase, but as far as I know, the sex in the hearing room was not an attempt to overturn the results of an election. And the other thing was, so that's bad. Honestly, like both were in extremely poor taste. That can I offer you that? But the Pelosi thing was worse.
Nick,
I'm going to I don't want to sex shame anybody. I choose not to answer.
That's ridiculous. You know?
Christian.
Yeah, I mean,
what's your response?
Sure. Both obviously fireable offenses. One, an actual crime. So I guess that would be bad. The one thing I would say for the anal sex in the committee hearing room, this question's already make me uncomfortable, but it is perhaps a good metaphor of government's relationship to the taxpayer and the individual. So it does have that merit, despite it otherwise being in poor taste and just a bad place for it. So,
including with the surveillance, right? You
know, indeed, indeed.
Searing, penetrating metaphor of a post-war on terror America.
Guys, you had no, you have no idea how difficult it was to come up with a segment title here that was both funny and also even remotely appropriate.
It's almost like
sure
maybe segment titles
either,
are a bad
Peter.
Idea, Peter.
Yeah.
Al, that was a good question, but I just, I'm very upset that I ended up having to read that. Let's go to our lightning round, which we are going to call in the holy name of fraud. Harvard President Claudine Gay is out. She resigned from the presidency last week following a tempestuous congressional hearing over anti-Semitism on college campuses and multiple accusations of plagiarism. One thing we learned about this, maybe not that surprisingly, is that readers of the New York Times really, really care about what's going on at Harvard. I don't know if you guys followed the trending page on the New York Times website when, as this has been happening, they would have like these very worthy stories about like, you know, what's going on in Ukraine or you know, the Gaza, the wars in the world, like actually newsworthy stuff. All above the fold at the top of the page. And then the number one, number two, and number three stories would be like, number one would be what happened at Harvard. And then number two, three, and four would be our columnists weigh in on what happened at Harvard. So that's what I learned. Catherine, what did you learn from this kerfuffle?
I learned that my faith in the headline writing and lead writing of various mainstream media outlets up to and including the AP was, if anything, too high. Both, as you say, because of the obsessive focus on this at the Times, almost always with this vibe. But then the AP's coverage that had the explicit note that conservatives have found a new weapon that they are going to use for their perfidious ends. And it is someone's actual plagiarism that they did many, many years ago. Like, it's a bad take. It was a bad take. And I will note that the AP silently revised that lead to be less insane. They did not note the changes in the piece even after extensive secondary commentary on it. Here at Reason, we always note our changes. We do not make stealth edits. And so that makes it doubly annoying that we ended up on a list of sources of disinformation because our corrections policy wasn't transparent enough. Screw you. The AP's corrections policy isn't transparent enough. Ours is perfectly good. So what I'm really saying is I'm still mad about being called a dangerous source of misinformation on the internet. And Claudine Gay is secondary to that.
Christian, what did you learn?
I think the primary thing that I learned is that I still don't care about anything that happens at Harvard or Yale. But
not a big NewYorkTimes.com reader then.
No, not so much.
What do you? How do you spend your day?
Yeah. to not do too much counter programming, I guess the main thing I learned is that relearned is that so much of the work product of academia is just kind of useless and no one is reading it. Like, it's kind of remarkable that someone rose to the top of the most prestige academic institution in the country while having papers that were just, you know, plagiarized. And it's probably because no one really cares what she was actually writing.
Nick, What did you learn?
What I'm interested in is, you know, we all know the concept of a milkshake duck. And I always think when I think of milkshake duck, I think of milkshake duck and I think of it as a him, excuse me, but as a Pokemon. And I think what we are witnessing with the whole Claudine Gay thing is the evolution of the Pokemon milkshake duck into something new and beautiful, because Bill Ackman, the you know, bazillionaire who targeted Claudine Gay because he's a big donor to Harvard and was like, oh my God, until all this happened, I didn't realize that Harvard is a piece of shit institution, blah, 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 and it's filled with all of this. As a result of his activism, his wife, who was formerly a tenured, a full professor at MIT's Media Lab, was then, somebody went through her work and found instances where she didn't fully attribute work in her dissertation, which was turned into a book. She apologized for that. Somebody else found stuff about Jeffrey Epstein going into, funding the MIT Media Lab in a big way, and Bill Ackman trying to shut down public conversations of that. So the milkshake duck is now this kind of weird animal that, you know, in its evolution, in its second phase, has immense power to bleed out all over the universe. And even Chris Rufo, who was caught up in all of this, he was somewhat chastised because he calls himself a Harvard grad, but then he actually went to the Harvard Extension School, which is like...
Yeah, that's not real Harvard. We all know that.
It's like that was on the back of Marvel Comics in the 1970s. It's like LaSalle Extension
School. Learn to draw at the Harvard Extension School.
Yeah, and it's like, and then he was like, how dare you? My degree, although it's not a degree, apparently, it's like a seminar fulfillment or whatever. So what I like about this is the milkshake duck, you know, for those of you still playing Pokemon Go, or not Pokemon Go, but the battle games.
By for which those I mean of you Robbie still following Suave, this metaphor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we need to explain?
Milkshake duck is now the most powerful being in our universe, which has been taken over.
Can we briefly explain for people who live good and righteous, upright lives what milkshake duck is, which is
I just need to recommend you see the 1980s movie Howard the Duck.
No.
And then you'll understand.
I'm going to help the people out. In 2016, there was a post by the account Pixelated Boat, which just said, oh, look, here's a cute duck that drinks milkshakes. And then we regret to inform you the duck is racist. And that's the idea, is you go pop, you become popular on the internet for something good. Yeah. And you immediately get your background checked out. It turns out
the timer starts on the milkshake ducking of Ken Bone
is the genesis of the milkshake duck. For those of you who can remember,
right,
that
he
red
was into,
sweater.
He was into milkshake ducks, or what was his particular scandal again?
His milkshake duck fetish was revealed. Nope.
All right, I think it is time to move on to our final segment, Whatcha Watching. I am going to take moderator's privilege and start. I read the novel The Schismatrix by Bruce Sterling. It is a 1980s sci-fi novel. Sterling is often associated with the cyberpunk movement because of his editorship of the Mirror Shades trilogy, of the Mirror Shades anthology and his work with William Gibson. But this is not exactly cyberpunk. It is space opera, and specifically, it is space opera about anarchy. It's set in a future that is approaching the singularity. There is an ongoing conflict between two major groups called the Shapers and the Mechanists. And at the start of the novel, there's like a big youth resistance against the radical old, who are consuming all the resources but with all the technology that they need to stay alive for so long. And then we have our hero, who bums off to an unaffiliated colony after an act of protest and resistance against the radical old. And this unaffiliated colony, he meets up first with some like black market biotech people who make black market drugs, and then an unaffiliated independent journalist. And then he has to go to the Geisha Bank, which is basically the brothel workers union. And the brothel workers control the currency, which on this particular little outpost is actually sex hours. And that's how you pay for everything. And then he ends up with a bunch of pirates who are, in fact, the remnants of an old mining nation, but there's only like 11 of them left, and all of them are both members of the government and billionaires because they've inflated their currency so much, and just like citizens and members of the military as well. And that's like the first 35 or 40 pages, and then it keeps going from there. And it's just fantastic because it's just this book about how progress and technology shape absolutely everything, and the whole, and like human relationships and existence are just self-organized weird little interest groups that reorganize all the time based on the ways that people's interests change and the changing of technology and social and political organizations. Strongly recommended. It is one of the best and most amusing fictional treatments of anarchy I have ever read. It is The Schismatrix by Bruce Sterling. Catherine, let's go to you next.
Yeah, so there's a new movie out of the latest installment of the Hunger Games series by Suzanne Collins. I've not seen the movie, but I thought I would read the book because I have a tween daughter, and therefore the book just like manifested in my home somehow. So I read The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, which is a prequel to The Hunger Games. It gives us the backstory on President Snow. And it's basically public choice, the novel. It's like a really, really actually quite good. I enjoyed the Hunger Games books. I think generally it's good for the youth of America to read stories about how the government will try to distract you with bread and circuses in order to fuel its various evil activities. But this book in particular, it joins the, I think, deeply annoying genre of let's humanize our main villain, but does so in a way that is, you know, at least to my eye, you know, informed by public choice theory. We basically have a person whose family has long been in power seeking to support and build out the institutions that might keep him in power even as the world changes around him. And, you know, there's still like a lot of gruesome teenager death and stuff like that. So, you know, depends on whether or not that's your vibe. But The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, pretty good. I cannot speak for the movie. Looking at the trailer, it looks like what if Draco Malfoy was in The Hunger Games is kind of the vibe that they came up with. And frankly, it's not a bad marketing concept, but I don't know how it's going to play out in film form. So let me know if I should see it.
I actually saw the movie and I wrote about it for theoldreason.com. You can read my review there. But the short version is, I thought it looked nice. It's a good production, and it's also too long and it falls a little flat. And one of the big things that it does that I think is a problem is that it actually loses a bunch of the political dimensions that were so important to the first trilogy. And it sounds like to the book, which I haven't read. Christian, what have you been watching, listening to, reading, etc.?
Yeah, I read the book Fatherland, which is kind of like a noir detective novel set in 1960s Nazi Germany, which, you know, keen students of history will notice an incongruency there.
Alert readers.
Right. So it's an alternate history novel set in the Third Reich if the Nazis had won the war. It's a great dystopian novel. It's a really great fast-paced mystery novel. The one thing that stuck out to me reading it most recently, particularly since we were talking about the TSA earlier, is that there's a bit in the novel where the detective character, Xavier March, he has to take a plane to Switzerland, and he manages to get through airport security in Nazi Germany without having to take off his belt or his shoes. Mm. So who's the real
Nazis?
Take
that, Nikki Haley.
So that's like the Man in the High Castle. That's the alternate timeline we need to capture and bring into our lives.
Exactly. The one piece of advice I would give listeners who maybe do pick up the book is do not make my mistake and get the copy of the dust jacket that just has a giant swastika on it. So, tough play.
Maybe read that one.
On the metro. Yeah.
Robert Harris, the novelist who wrote that book, also wrote a series of alternate history books set in interesting places, often with a sort of a fun mystery at the heart of it. And so if you like mysteries set in history, he's got, you know, one in Pompeii. He's got another one set in as the Roman era. And they're both more and less nerdy than that sounds, right? They're extremely accessible, just like very easy beach reads, but also like you're going to learn a whole bunch of like nifty details about the period and the time. Nick, what have you been watching and consuming?
I read the book Warhol After Warhol, Secrets, Lies, and Corruptions in the Art World by the art critic Richard Dormant. It's a fantastic look at two Warhol paintings that were decertified or deauthenticated by the Warhol Authentication Board. Andy Warhol, who died in 1986, had produced thousands of works, and he gave all of them to the Warhol Foundation, the ones that weren't already in private hands. And they eventually created an authentication board to come up with a way of saying, this is an actual Warhol, this is not. And this book goes into particularly a series of controversial self-portraits that Warhol did called the Red Series in the mid-1960s. And they deauthenticated one, which was clearly a work that was produced by Andy Warhol. And of course, a lot of Andy Warhol's, you know, genius was in questioning and kind of deconstructing or playing with the very idea of authorship, because a lot of his work was done by silkscreen. It was mechanically produced and reproduced and things like that. And so, you know, if nothing else, his work is how much does an artist or does a producer, a creator need to be involved for something to be seen as his or her work? He played with that. And this book is a fantastic, deep dive into that philosophically and artistically and aesthetically. And it extends far beyond anything related to, you know, something like art or music or literature, but then also into the way that the Warhol Foundation and various people who were deeply interested in making decisions about what was considered a real Warhol versus a fake Warhol. It's just a tremendously fascinating book. If you care about the work of art, to paraphrase or to cite Walter Benjamin's unbelievably influential essay from the 1930s, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, I highly, highly recommend Warhol After Warhol, Secrets, Lies, and Corruption in the Art World by Richard Dormant.
Nick, do you have any announcements for us upcoming?
Yes, I do. I just came into possession of many inauthentic Andy Warhols that I'm willing to sell at auction at very high prices. And if I just, I mean, on that, the Warhol board, the authentication board, which ended up being in a big lawsuit and disbanding after this, they took things which were clearly fake Warhols and made them authentic Warhols itself. I mean, it's such a Warholian story. The event that I will tell you about in New York City is not quite that, although it might get there. On January 22nd, Peter, I'm going to be hosting a live taping of the Reason interview. We call them the Reason Speakeasy in Midtown Manhattan with David Stockman, Ronald Reagan's original budget director, whose political memoir, The Triumph of Politics, Why the Reagan Revolution Failed, is a classic of the genre. Since then, Stockman has emerged as a great libertarian firebrand, as well as a perpetual bear when it comes to the market. His new book is called Trump's War on Capitalism, and we're going to be talking about that and what he sees as defining in 2024 and beyond. So it's Monday, January 22nd, a Reason Speakeasy. Go to reason.com/events to buy tickets and get details. These are always great events.
That sounds great. Join Nick and co. if you can. So thank you, as always. This has been the Reason Roundtable podcast. If you like our work, you can donate at reason.com/donate. And if you want to work with us, we are hiring. reason.com/jobs. That's reason.com/jobs. You can go to see what positions we have open. Thank you, as always. Matt Welch, we'll be back next week.